supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Could Donald Trump's stunning success in Pennsylvania last week inspire copycat campaigns for governor? I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Democrat Tom Wolf is up for re-election in 2018, and one independently wealthy Republican has already said he'll take a run at the job. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
If you haven't heard of State Senator Scott Wagner yet, trust me, you will. Franklin and Marshall College political scientist Stephen Medvick says Wagner is a new force in Pennsylvania politics, and it's hard to talk about him without referring to Donald Trump.
He's a first-term state senator. He won his election as a write-in candidate.
You heard that right, a write-in. Wagner was for years a conservative outsider in York County, criticizing establishment Republicans as soft on conservative principles and beholding to special interests. 2 years ago, Wagner ran against the party-backed candidate in a special election and won his seat with write-in votes, a stunning achievement not unlike Trump beating a Republican presidential field stocked with establishment candidates. Wagner's win put the outsider on the inside in Harrisburg, and party leaders soon learned he wouldn't be a quiet member of the Senate caucus.
I'm going to be sitting in the back room with a baseball bat, and leadership's going to start doing things for Pennsylvania that needs done.
That was Wagner on the Dom Giordano radio show. Wagner soon had an impact. He was part of a group that ousted Delaware County Senator Dominic Pileggi, a moderate, from the post of majority leader, replacing him with Jake Corman of Center County, who's more conservative. But Wagner began spending his own money to support Republican candidates, and he's now an accepted leader of the party. He was a featured speaker at a caucus of the Pennsylvania delegation at the Republican convention in July in Cleveland.
Let me tell you, I'm in the garbage business, and I am probably the most competitive person in the world.
Indeed, Wagner made his fortune in the solid waste industry, and he showed his competitive mettle this year when he chaired the State Senate Republican Campaign Committee. The party won 4 competitive seats and captured a supermajority in the Senate, a 34-16 margin over Democrats. Wagner didn't just lead. Joe Aronson, director of the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, says he invested personally, especially in knocking off Erie Democrat Sean Wiley.
Between his own personal funds and the political action committees that he controlled, he put over $500,000 into that race.
Wagner has said he identifies with Trump, a businessman who wants to shake things up. He says he plans to run for governor in 2018 and write a 7-figure check to his own campaign fund. Can he pull it off? First, he has to win a Republican primary. Gloria Lee Snover is chair of the Northampton County Republican Party and an early Trump supporter. She says she likes Wagner's business background and no-nonsense approach.
However, I think there's going to be other businessmen run as well. I think you're going to see several mini Donald Trumps come out.
Snover says she's already been approached by one she won't name. There are many other potential Republican candidates, including Senate Majority Leader Corman, House Speaker Mike Terzai, and Western Pennsylvania Congressman Mike Kelly. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
In the midst of a national opioid crisis, a spate of new dental initiatives in Pennsylvania and New Jersey is taking aim at preventing the misuse of some prescription painkillers. WHYY's Alana Gordon reports.
Dentists are among the leading prescribers of pain pills such as Vicodin. This month, New Jersey's largest dental association released new prescribing guidelines. They never had any before. Dr. Elisa Velasquez, a pediatric dentist in Ocean County, says one aim is to educate dentists on prescription drug misuse and being mindful of what's appropriate.
Because remember, we're dealing with acute pain. It's painful right now and maybe the next 2 days. You don't need a month's worth of pain medication. So that would be one of the takeaway messages.
The group says that's especially important because for the millions of young adults who get their wisdom teeth out each year, that prescription may very well be their first experience with an opioid. The guidelines also point out that anti-inflammatory drugs, including ibuprofen, may be safer and more effective for dealing with dental pain. Nationwide, opioids have been a main driver of drug overdoses. New Jersey tracked more than 1,000 related deaths in 2014. Pennsylvania came out with guidelines for dentists a couple years ago. But this month, the Commonwealth enacted a new law. It requires additional opioid education for dentists and other doctors. I'm Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
On May 13th, 1985, Philadelphia police dropped explosives on the rooftop property at 6221 Osage Avenue, home of the radical protest group MOVE's headquarters. 11 MOVE members were killed, including 5 children. The resulting fire destroyed 65 other homes. Now, 31 and a half years on, the Philadelphia Redevelopment Authority announced this week that until December 14th at 3 p.m., it will accept proposals from developers to purchase and revive 36 vacant properties along and nearby that West Philadelphia block. Gerald Wayne Renfro is the 6200 Osage Avenue block captain and president of Osage Pine Community Association and joins me now. Mr. Renfro, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Good afternoon, Mr. Heller.
Mr. Renfro, I understand that you grew up in that neighborhood. Your parents live nearby.
My parents purchased a home in the 6200 block of Osage Avenue, and that's where they raised me and my brothers and sisters. Yes, that's correct.
What is that community, what are those blocks like now? Certainly never close to being restored to what they were like when you were first growing up there.
Well, on the 6200 block of Pine Street on the south side of the street, there's only 3 occupants. All of the rest of the homes are boarded up. And so it looks like a ghost town there. On the 6200 block of Osage Avenue, there's more homeowner occupancy, but still there's a tremendous amount of homes that are boarded up. And what we have to endure and what we have been enduring is the drug dealers who come in under the cover of the boards and the darkness from the unoccupied houses, and they do their transactions. In addition, the prostitutes, they bring their johns there, and they do their business, and so we have to contend with that. We've also had muggers. Our neighbors have been mugged. We've had squatters who come in and occupy properties. We've had to deal with that for the last 16 years since Mr. Street boarded up all the homes.
To what extent, then, are you hopeful that the Redevelopment Authority announcement this week will eventually go toward rectifying at least some aspects of this situation you're painting?
Well, the street administration and the Nutter administration said that their developers and their contractors had all agreed that the homes were so poorly constructed that they all had to be torn down, and we had to sell out to the city. They had to reconstruct the whole area. Okay, well, what we did, my wife Connie, as a matter of fact, asked me to called the Army Corps of Engineers again, and we took them on a tour, and they did an evaluation and found out each home could be brought up to code for a nominal amount, say $20,000 or less. So we just strongly don't believe that there would be a necessitation to demolish anything. And if any developer suggested that, we would ask Mayor James Kenney to engage the United States Army Corps of Engineers to come out and do a reevaluation, because we really don't trust anyone but them, and they have an excellent reputation, but there are some developers who don't.
What's the best case scenario as you see it moving forward?
The best case scenario would be for a developer to purchase the properties properly, restore the properties, and sell them to qualified homeowners. And if they could do that, then we believe that all the vices that we are confronted with every day will go away on their own, and we believe that we could return to a normal way of living in safety in our beautiful location with the park right at the corner.
Gerald Wayne Renfro is the 6200 Osage Avenue block captain and president of Osage Pine Community Association. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Still ahead this evening, A woman recalls her reaction to the surprise discovery that her grandfather was an infamous Nazi commandant.
Absolutely surreal, shocking as well, but not shocking in the sense that I would scream or, you know, you'd see it from the outside. No, it was very quiet. I was not able to breathe properly.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Under President-elect Donald Trump, Pennsylvania's natural gas industry could see higher production, fewer environmental restrictions, and more pipelines to take its products to market, all while its struggling coal industry may also get more help. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports on what his presidency could mean for the Commonwealth energy sector.
Trump's win was a big surprise to everyone, including people in the oil and gas industry. In fact, they gave more money to Hillary Clinton's campaign, according to an analysis by the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. But this election is a good surprise, says Matt Henderson, a consultant who works with drilling companies.
You know, Pennsylvania's success is really dependent upon the national success out there.
Trump has pledged to reduce the size of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and roll back regulations.
And having, you know, again, the Trump administration in there putting more of a business-minded approach out there, looking at weighing everything equally, will help Pennsylvania's economy to continue to grow, especially in the oil and gas sector.
Under Trump, Henderson says the federal government is expected to become a lot friendlier to fossil fuels.
I think the biggest difference we're going to see is, you know, these federal agencies now are going to realize that really they work for the people and it's not the other way around.
But the states still get a say in what happens. For example, earlier this year, New York State, which has a Democratic governor and banned fracking within its borders, denied necessary permits to a major gas transmission pipeline planned to move Marcellus shale gas to New England. And more recently, a new gas liquids pipeline was delayed in the Commonwealth. The company cited problems getting permits from Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection. Henderson says it will still be good to have an industry cheerleader in the White House.
I think that pressure that coming down from the federal government will help move those projects along and take out the politics again and make it more of a maybe a business decision versus how it's been done in the past.
Trump will get to make new appointments to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is charged with oversight of interstate gas pipelines. He's also pledged to cancel the Paris Climate Accord, revive the coal industry, and open up more federal land to oil and gas drilling. For the environmental community, his win is a major blow.
Pennsylvania has been in a really difficult position relative to oil and gas even before the election.
Joanne Kilgour heads the state chapter of the Sierra Club.
We saw just this past year what a difficult fight it was to secure even baseline common sense regulations for the unconventional oil and gas industry.
She expects many of the same fights to continue in Harrisburg over drilling regulations and permitting for new gas pipelines.
And one positive outcome is that we've seen a lot of new energy from people on the ground who are joining organizations, donating to organizations, asking how they can get involved, and are really re-energized to help further the fight for the health and safety of our communities.
Governor Tom Wolf, a Democrat, says his administration is still committed to combating climate change. The state is in the midst of creating new rules for greenhouse gas emissions at oil and gas sites. And most states, including Pennsylvania, already have renewable energy standards. Those are targets for producing a certain amount of electricity from cleaner sources. That's good news to people like Rob Jackson, a researcher at Stanford University, who says Trump can't single-handedly undo the forces propelling cleaner energy.
He can't derail renewables completely, and I'm not sure he wants to. The costs for wind and solar are plummeting, and market forces are too strong. My source of optimism comes primarily from the states and cities and local actions that are happening.
On the campaign trail, Trump promised to bring back coal, while at the same time promoting robust natural gas development. His message clearly resonated in Pennsylvania, which has lost roughly 3,000 coal jobs in the past 4 years. Gas drilling has also slowed significantly amid low commodity prices. But the rhetoric of promoting both coal and gas doesn't align with reality, says Emily Hammond, a law professor at George Washington University.
truly those two resources are competing right now for that presence in the electric market. And so the idea of having both of those come to the forefront is hard to square with those market forces.
It remains to be seen what campaign promises Trump will be able to follow through with. Just before the election results were in, federal analysts predicted the coming year will mirror current trends, with a decline in coal, expanded use of natural gas, and a growing footprint for renewable energy. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
A book has the power to transform a life. Some 9 years ago, a patron perusing the psychology section of the Hamburg, Germany Central Library paused at the title, "I Have to Love My Father, Don't I?" The subsequent research begat another book called My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me. With that, let's speak to author Jennifer Tiga. Jennifer, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
The subtitle of your book is A Black Woman Discovers Her Family's Nazi Past. Long before that discovery date in that Hamburg library, you knew very little about your past because, in part, you were put up at an orphanage at the age of some 4 weeks.
Yeah, that's true. My mother and my biological father, who is Nigerian, have separated before I was born. So I was placed in an orphanage by my mother when I was 4 weeks old, and I grew up in the orphanage. I was later taken care by a foster family who eventually adopted me when I was 7 years old. But I was in contact with my mother, my biological mother, and my grandmother because they would visit me sporadically or I would visit them.
Jennifer, fast forward to this August day in 2008.
Took my kids to kindergarten, and I went to the Central Library. It's a big library, the biggest one in town. When I saw a book on the shelf, so I could only read the spine, the title was I Have to Love My Father, Don't I? I picked the book up from the shelf, and very quickly I looked at the cover. I saw a tiny little photograph, and I could read the subtitle. The subtitle said, Monika Goethe, daughter of the concentration camp commandant from Schindler's List. There was another picture, a few pages thereafter, and it was a picture of an older woman, and she wore a flowery summer dress. For all these years, I had kept one single picture of my biological grandmother, and the woman in on the picture wore the exact same dress, and there was also a caption under the photo, and it said, Ruth Irene Goethe. Ruth Irene Goethe was the name of my biological grandmother. So very fast, I was skimming through the rest of the book, and at the very end, there was a summarization of biographical details. And these details perfectly matched the information that I had surrounding my adoption paperwork. So this was the moment when I realized that the book that I was holding in my hands was not just a random book. No, it was a book that told the story of my biological mother.
It must have been a moment both surreal and shocking.
Absolutely surreal, shocking as well, but not shocking in the sense that I would scream or, you know, what you would see it from the outside. No, it was very quiet. I was not able to breathe properly. I wanted to somehow lie down. And then I started reading the book. And that was when I discovered who my grandfather was, Amon Goethe.
You knew of him certainly before. In fact, in part, just by being a student in Germany, Holocaust courses were taught. And apparently, when you lived in Israel for some 4 or 5 years, you saw on television Schindler's List.
In the movie, he's portrayed by Ralph Fiennes. He was the nemesis of Oskar Schindler. So Amon Goethe was the one who killed the Jews, and he was the commandant of the camp. I wasn't so familiar with the historical details. I more had the image of the movie character, but to realize that it was a person, like a real person of flesh and blood, this was something that was not new to me, but it was step by step I realized.
But completely new to you was the realization that Goethe's wife, your grandmother, was undoubtedly aware of at least some of what was going on.
I've seen the movie Schindler's List, and if you've seen the movie Schindler's List, you may remember a scene where there is a woman in bed, and when Amon Goethe is on the balcony shooting at prisoners, the woman takes the blanket over her head and says, please stop because I can't stand the noise. So I knew that scene, but I never imagined that this would be my biological grandmother, because the woman that I had known as a child was not that woman with no empathy for no one. It was a woman that was very caring and loving towards me as a child.
Jennifer Tiga, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
My pleasure.
Jennifer Tiga, author of My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me, A Black Woman Discovers Her Family's Nazi Past. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.